Dr. Leonie Tanzer joins the Pootopia podcast this time. Her work on technology-facilitated abuse describes the misuse or repurposing of digital systems to harass, coerce, or abuse. She explores the intersection of technology, cybersecurity, and gender.
Products that are marketed for protection are actually, you know, misused. So things like CCTV cameras that are internet connected and allow people to basically install it and monitor a person in a household while they are not physically there. Equally, doorbells, which is so funny because there's this whole effort of our police forces, you know, handing out Ring doorbells, for example, for protective purposes. But again, if you're thinking of a coercive and controlling environment that is often very gendered, and let's be honest, unfortunately, in most heterosexual households, the people that are in charge of digital systems are men. So they are the account holders, they've set it up, they decide when it's going to be disposed of. So if they are in charge of the Ring doorbell, so to say, they will be able to monitor when you come and go, or who else is coming and going.
Hey everybody, welcome to the latest episode of the Pootopia News Network podcast. I'm John Lipkoski, one of the co-hosts, and the other co-hosts are Scoop Sweeney and Wendy Grossman. And the three of us today are going to be talking to Leonie Tanzer, a leading researcher on the intersection of technology, security, and gender. Tanzer's work explores how digital technologies, including smartphones, smart home devices, surveillance tools, and AI systems, can be weaponized in situations of domestic abuse and coercive control. As homes fill with internet-connected devices, new forms of technologies of facilitated abuse are emerging, allowing perpetrators to monitor, manipulate, and intimidate victims remotely. We discussed the hidden social costs of the Internet of Things, the concept of safety by design, and the challenges of regulating emerging technologies, and why cybersecurity must focus not only on protecting systems, but also on protecting people. The conversation also explores broader questions about privacy, power, digital autonomy, and how AI and connected technologies may reshape both personal freedom and social control in the years ahead. So, Leonie, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And I hope my introduction was completely accurate, because I think that we understand your breadth of study and research.
Yeah, I'm flattered. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And I think my first question is, since you're focused on, you're very much focused on technology facilitated domestic violence and abuse, and I'm wondering what brought you to this area of study, and did you find anything surprising as you got into it?
Yeah, the origin story is, well, quite convoluted, but I'll try to explain it in simple like steps, because I feel I fell into this. The real click happened when I was a postdoc at a big research grant in the UK, where several researchers were working on smart internet connected devices, and we studied the development of these systems from various perspectives. So it was like dozens of researchers with different backgrounds coming quite frequently together to talk about like issues around privacy, security, safety, you name it. And throughout those meetings, I sometimes sat and was quite surprised how some of the colleagues were super excited about some of the features that like will be or are being embedded in some of these devices and systems. And I always just sat there and felt like, Jesus, have you thought how that could be misused? And out of, I would say, I wouldn't say personal experience, but because of my background and my exposure to certain things, I immediately thought like of some of the worst contexts where this could be, you know, misused, and domestic abuse is something that's very close to my heart. And I just thought like the features that were meant to be helping people would be so easily converted to become, you know, tools of control, tools of misuse against these really incredibly vulnerable people, which are victims and survivors of intimate partner violence. And so, yeah, it through this kind of wake up of like the euphoria of some of my colleagues and my skepticism on the other side, I just started like thinking, bringing that up and like realizing, okay, I didn't see much discussion on that. I didn't see much research on that. And so I just felt like I had to research this and study this and bring that to the forefront of the discourse and especially of the technical community.
Well, you know, the whole history of the internet is kind of like that. It's like we started the internet and we thought it was going to be utopia, and we wouldn't let ourselves think too much about the dystopian possibilities. Does that sound kind of like what we're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to simplify like that all technology, like, you know, has that downfall of humanity to it. I mean, as we know, the internet brought many great things with it. And so the smart internet connected devices, I think it's just important to recognize as we are developing anything. And again, it doesn't have to be smart, like just in engineering. And I think that is where the intersection is really interesting. When we think about engineering, we have a history of safety research and like knowing not to harm people and all of that. But I think when it comes to tech and cybersecurity, we think about security of the system, not of how the system could be misused. And I think that is the shift that we need to put forward to our students when we teach students and when anyone goes into that field. I think we need to put the glasses on that engineering sciences has for a very long time around like how, if we build a bridge, how can we make sure it doesn't harm people by breaking down?
The amazing thing is that it's not even that new a problem. I think it must be about 15 years or maybe a bit more since I was at a Computers Freedom and Privacy conference, one of the last ones we had. And Cindy Southworth, who at the time was the head of the National Network for Ending Domestic Violence, did a presentation on what she called stalker apps, which were nominally billed as apps to let parents monitor their children and make sure their children are okay. But some of the advertising, even then, around was quite blatant, you know, that you could use it to follow your partner around, too. But what you're talking about is even worse in that it's not that easy to install an app on somebody else's phone. But I think one of the examples you've used to me is you have a remote control in your house that controls the lights and the television and various other things. And you split up with your partner and your partner still has access to it.
Yeah, what I normally refer to is I think we're moving away from a society where we each one have one device that with one account that is connected to us and only us. So PC, personal computer, that is, you know, first of all, most people don't have laptops, computers anymore. They go through the internet on their phones anyway, and or tablets. And tablets are often shared with children, with partners, whatever. And I think with IoT or smart connected devices, it's the same kind of development where we need to account for the fact that they're used, owned perhaps by one person, but equally perhaps there should be technically a shared ownership, but like used by different people that all have different preferences and demands and expectations. But because we are so used to only allow for these settings to be changed by one person and it can't be dynamic to whoever the user at that moment of time is, we fail to kind of protect people that like are falling under the radar because they're not the legal and, you know, financial owners of this device. And so I think that is the important transition that like we need to again fix as well. It's like the move from personal devices where each person can easily say yes, no to whatever the consent or features are, to the shared device environment that we're moving into.
You know, one thing I think would be interesting to hear as we're getting into this is if you have any, some real world examples or maybe anecdotes, things that you're aware of that have happened that sort of are examples of the kinds of things we're talking about.
Yeah, and I want to start by saying people really easily latch on the high tech examples because they're, you know, Black Mirror type, you know, cases, and, you know, they are sensational. But I really want to first start by saying the mundane abuse is the one that we see most. And that might look boring and it might not be technically sophisticated, but it is the most prevalent. You know, I can, of course, give you some of the more extreme examples, but I really want to stress that, like, by zooming in on those, we disregard fixing the problems that, like, kind of easy things, so to say, are creating. So to give you the full breadth of this then, so we have anything from, like, you know, what people always think is hacking, you know, but people just guess passwords, you know, and that applies also to smart devices. So I don't need to, for example, you know, coerce you necessarily, because if you have the same password that or still use the same password that we had when we broke up, and I used to know your Netflix password then, I still know it now, and perhaps you use it also on, you know, your heating system or your smart doorbell. I think security systems are a big thing that I'm quite concerned about and where we see a lot of abuse. So products that are marketed for protection are actually, you know, misused. So things like CCTV cameras that are internet connected and allow people to basically install it and monitor a person in a household while they are not physically there. Equally, doorbells, which is so funny because there's this whole effort around police forces, you know, handing out Ring doorbells, for example, for protective purposes. But again, if you're thinking of a coercive and controlling environment that is often very gendered, and let's be honest, unfortunately, in most heterosexual households, the people that are in charge of digital systems are men. So they are the account holders, they've set it up, they decide when it's going to be disposed of. So if they are in charge of the Ring doorbell, so to say, they will be able to monitor when you come and go, or who else is coming and going. Equally, we see that with, you know, thermostats. Again, there might be, you know, tiny details, you know, that someone is currently using it or switching it on or in the house or whatever. And equally with smart locks, because we've done some tests actually with smart locks. And there's, again, what I've mentioned previously, the fact that there's the idea that there's one account holder and several guests that use the lock. And that's not how a house door works, you know. I'm sure if the four of us would live together, all four of us would like to be in control of the door and not just you, John, right? And so I think that these are some of the example of the, I would say, mundane examples. We then see, I would say, a bit more, I wouldn't say sophisticated, but people thought a bit more about that, but that connects often with an element of gaslighting. So the best example I can give you is I remember very vividly that we were asked very early in the project and in our research what the abilities of a smart vacuum cleaner are, like, for example, a Roomba. And anyone who listens and who is feeling quite techie or tech capable will laugh at this. But we generally were asked questions around, like, you know, has it a camera? Has it, like, tracking functionality? But also things like, could you install a knife? And you might laugh hearing this. But again, thinking about a domestic abuse and intimate partner violence situation where you constantly are questioned and, like, don't know, Can I, what can I trust and not? The fact that someone can tell you, there is a camera in there, even if it's technically not possible, or similarly, a knife in there might stick in your mind and you perhaps change your behavior around that device because of that. So that is a quite a vivid example I can give. And of course, then like, unfortunately, the now with car tracking, and that tracking also goes along with like devices such as Tile or AirTag. So you don't even need to have the capability in the car itself, although that functionality is there because so many cars now have, apps associated with them that mean you can track where a person has driven to. You can also just install or just drop basically a smart AirTag into the car without and follow a person around where they're going.
Well, I've been looking at some offenses of various devices, and the most current one right now is the use of flock license plate reader cameras in the U.S. and the abuse by law enforcement to not just combat crime, but to track their lovers and their girlfriends or people they're attracted to. And in the last 2 days, I've seen like four different, I did a little research, and there's four different arrests or complaints against law enforcement in four different states, one in Texas, one in South Carolina, another in, well, actually two in Texas. They would go online and track the movements of the person, and I just has there been a similar problem like that outside the U.S. in the U.K. or Euro?
I mean, not so. It's not specific to this technology. It's more about the profession. So generally, when victims and survivors are seeking help, what happens is internationally there will be a risk assessment. There's different risk assessments out there, but basically it's a questionnaire where people like check out like how is their situation. For example, there's questions in there: are you pregnant? Have you been strangled, for example, which are all escalating factors that is very like that showcases, for example, to a social worker, okay, that is really a dangerous situation. And for example, in the context that you just described, one thing that we are also seeing, I mean, that's for domestic abuse in general, but also for tech abuse specifically, is if a partner is in the military, in police, or in tech. These are very, that's some alarm bells should go off because they have access to technology or might be more tech savvy due to their profession. And so that's one of the things that is equivalent in the UK and globally, that it's the ability to access certain functionalities, being aware of them, that can then lead to the misuse of them.
Are there cases of, and I'm sure there must be, but cases where, let's say you have a, well, we refer to like battered women, abused women who are hiding from their spouses. Are there cases where purely with technology, the spouse has been able to track down the other, and how could we design against that possibility?
Yeah. So yes, that is a very classical scenario. And it's mundane. Again, I call it mundane things. So for example, we know of instances where and globally it's so it's when you go into a women's shelter or refuge, normally these the addresses are not known for the sake that like other women, whoever goes there, are protected from being tracked down. And again, with technology, the problem has become that like any woman that enters, or also women and their children that enter a refuge, could bring technology that could lead to the identification through like where the location of the refuge is, not just for that partner, but also the partner could then give it away and post online. And so then that safe house is no longer safe. And so that is a very common problem. And one of the things people like give away, for which technology gives away locations, is not just like that, again, a tracker is hidden in, for example, the car or a purse, but it's like things like gifts that have been given to children, like smart toys that like are still connected and geolocation. It is mundane things like, for example, children are still, for example, using their Xbox, have brought the Xbox into the refuge and they're playing. And the former partner, the da, whoever, is still connecting to them. I mean, that is not even like super tech, like that is just communication, but that is something that people haven't thought about because it's easy to say, don't use your phone, but because of the functionalities in online games, people can still go connected with them. Other things are food delivery services. You know, in refuges, perhaps you order Indian or Chinese, and when you enter the address, because you've changed, you might use still the same account, but you changed the address because it should now be delivered to the refuge, and the partner has access to that account, they will see where it gets delivered to. So these are like things that like you need to think about first. And like, of course, no delivery service has thought about that when they designed this. So your question was, how could you design against this? One important factor that like we feel is so obsolete in most of IoT devices is lessons we have already learned so many years ago with other internet capabilities. So reminders. So just like you get a reminder once in a while, for example, from Dropbox or from Gmail to say, by the way, this IP address, with this IP address, someone has logged in to your account. We don't have that very much like with IoT devices, and that should be basically transferred, because then I know, for example, I get a reminder saying you're still logged in with that account in these three devices, or right now someone has logged in and checked your settings, etc.
I saw an interview with a private investigator who specialized in tracking down those kind of problems, and his best advice was, if you suspect that somebody is tracking you, take your phone to your car or whatever place that you might be suspicious of, and turn on your Bluetooth and look and see if there is an unknown Bluetooth device in your vicinity. And very often, that's how he said he would track down, those tags that people will stick onto cars to find out where they're going. And I found that to be very useful.
Yeah, a few things on that. Number one is I would always caution to give generic security and safety advice, unfortunately, because it's really important to recognize that, especially in domestic abuse situation, people are at different stages in that journey. And like some people, might not be, want to like gather evidence, but are still cohabiting with a partner, and they have to be 10 times more careful, for example, about certain things than if they are separated and actually just want to remove themselves totally. Or they are in this really dangerous phase where they kind of try to escape without the person knowing. So, for example, in this context, yes, you can do that. But what would be the consequence, for example, of you identifying it? How would you how should a victim and survivor react? Because should they then keep it there? Should they remove it? And that depends on their situation. And it's important. That's why I'm really stressing the need to have that risk assessment and that safety plan with a professional in a support capacity, so they know, okay, perhaps it's safer to just leave it there, or in this context, it might be better to remove it. And on that point, we have done studies on what another new phenomena is on kind of hidden spy devices, and also tested commercially available what we call spy trackers. So you referred to a professional, and there is a whole sector of TCSM. I think that's the professional term, technical surveillance countermeasures. And there's a whole sector of people that profit from financially from offering that service to victims and survivors. But equally, you can easily go to Amazon right now and order a so-called spy detector. They range from, you know, £50 to up the possibilities, whatever is in your budget. And we actually looked at a range of them and their functionalities and features and usability, and they're not very good and great. And I think that's also something important to recognize, that like, I'm always hesitant to give generic advice, because again, like tomorrow that product could be out of, you know, unavailable, no longer updated, no longer safe. So for example, when it comes to these commercially available devices, we wouldn't right now see much. I couldn't assure a survivor 100% that when they use it, they'd know for sure that there is nothing, or that there is not, like the false positive issue is too high for us.
Well, I know with Apple products, or the AirTag specifically, if somebody was to plant an AirTag in my car, my iPhone would alert me to it. Though I wonder what would happen if I didn't have any Apple devices. I suppose that I wouldn't get any kind of alert in that case.
No, you would. So that is the beauty of industry collaboration. So Google and Apple have worked together. So even if you have an Android phone and you have an AirTag that is following you and in your like close proximity to you for a prolonged period of time, you would get the alert. I have gotten the alert before.
Oh, so that does raise the question of what you do in that case, as you were talking about earlier. And I think the thing I would be tempted to do is, if I can find the device, I think I'd just put it on somebody else's car. Or maybe find somebody who's traveling overseas and throw it into their bag.
Put it on a police car.
Yeah, exactly. That's a great idea, Scoop.
Well, I feel like you can only say that if you don't share, for example, children with that person and have some obligation to remain in touch with them.
Yeah, I get that point. So what about remote intimidation? What would be a way that someone could leverage technology to remotely intimidate somebody, not just to track them down, but just to kind of continue to be a thorn in their side?
You know, the question
would be pretty disturbing if the lights went on and off unpredictably.
Yeah, but equally, I feel like the question is kind of interestingly phrased, because in some ways I could give like some ideas to people listening and thinking like, that's actually awesome, I should do that. So I feel like
good point.
This is one of the dilemmas we're facing, which is we want to educate the public about functionalities and misuse, but equally don't want to give people ideas where they're like sitting and thinking, actually, that would really help me, in stalking, spying, coercing someone.
One form of, I guess, intimidation or bugging people that I can think of is doxing. And, that's kind of a common problem. I don't know whether it falls into the set of things that you're focused on, but I'm not sure what to do about that. I mean, if somebody puts your address information online, what can you do about it?
Yeah, I think a really important aspect is like the privacy laws that are in place as well. And I think, again, from a European perspective, there's much more you can do, for example, against data brokers, which are quite commonly a way of tracking down information or accumulated information about people. So a really important factor is that, like, I think anyone who is at risk and at risk is a very big category. I'm not referring here purely around domestic abuse victims, but like researchers. I mean, we talk about this in some of our ethics courses now with students about like, if you do high risk research, be careful about like what information is available about you, because, you know, you could end up being attacked by Elon Musk or someone like that.
How do you know when research is high risk? I mean, it's one of the things of our time is that things that seemed perfectly innocuous are suddenly high risk.
Well, I mean, in a university context, we actually, I mean, I can speak about UCL. There's very clear like criteria that you have to fulfill. And if anything, you would lean to the side of caution and automatically fall into the high risk category. That's why I always have a very lengthy ethics process, because I think the minute I submit something, the ethics committee says, ah, it's Leonie, so it's high risk. So I feel like in a research context, thankfully, we have quite like clear guidances, and we have ethics committees or ARBs in the US where it is being assessed. But of course, you're totally right. Like you can think you study something super like, you know, inoffensive that nobody could take any issue with, and the next day you might be quoted in an article in The Guardian in a way that like might misportray your research or has just become a politicized topic. And then, you know, you have a mob of people following you. So, yeah. So, I mean, I feel like that should be general, like kind of cyber hygiene, so to say, that people have to learn. And to come back to the doxing point, I think it's important that people kind of like do regular sessions of Googling their name and search. I when I teach courses at the university, I normally have an exercise where I have the students search themselves. And if they really are, you know, feeling like it, let others in the group search things about them. I think that's a good practice where you can see what could anyone actually find out about me.
Well, one of the more dangerous things that is being done recently is swatting, and that's putting in a false police report saying there's something dangerous or someone is in serious trouble. Send the police, and they of course show up, you know, with the weapons drawn. And there have been some really tragic situations where someone was killed just because they were swatted.
Yeah, I actually feel like this is more like 10 years ago. Like this is not like, I wouldn't say this is something super new. I think that reminds me more of like the days of Anonymous and you know, what was it called, the Roblox raid or whatever, Robo raid, what was it? But a bit of a time has passed. It's not to say that it doesn't happen still, but I think like that is
But the other aspect of that is that it's quite different in the States, where there are so many guns and the police are armed to a military extent. That is much less true in other countries, and swatting is not. Yeah, you know, I can't think of a case where, you know, somebody was killed in outside of the United States.
Yeah, you put a big problem these days. There's been recent swatting against politicians. Someone objects to someone's politics and they do a, you know, quick swat on them and hope that they get killed. And it's just a dangerous thing to do, but it gets done by crazy people.
Maybe that's the problem. Maybe we need to figure out what to do about all the crazy people. But meanwhile, so there's a kind of getting back to devices and technologies. There's this idea of safety by design. What principles would be associated with safety by design?
Yeah, safety by design is a big buzzword, and it's in many ways big principles. And I think that one of the big challenges is how could you make design principles that are applicable to different types of systems and technologies that would be generalizable, generic, and could be applied, but also concrete enough that they're, you know, implementable and enforceable. And so right now, safety by design principles are quite high level, you know, ensuring that like you, for example, have a high level of privacy or built in security by default, for example. So let's say, for example, the highest security settings at the start and highest privacy setting instead of like by default making everything open and accessible. But again, I can see, and that has been a critique from many industry actors, that like it is very hard to operationalize sometimes these design principles. So I think it is important that like while these principles are you know like applicable to all devices and all systems, that we, for example, implement technical standards and best practices specific to certain technologies, for example. And we have, for example, conducted research on smart internet connected devices where we tested several systems and then specifically for IoT devices came up with several suggestions what manufacturers could implement that wouldn't be necessarily applicable to, you know, anyone working on AI chatbots, for example.
So is it that there's not really a single set of principles, but it's sort of more contextual?
No, there is principles. Again, like they are very, you know, ensuring system reliability, being ethically considerate, you know, having plans for escalation or what to do when harm occurs. These are very generic things. And again, it's good practice for companies to sit down and think about these things. But I could see anyone leaning back and thinking, well, tell me exactly what I do want to need to do. And I think that's the challenge. So for example, in the UK, we have the Online Safety Act, and there are certain mandated things that companies have to do as a consequence of the act being enforced, but also there are, you know, guidelines. And guidelines is a really funny word, because again, it's good if you follow them, but we don't gonna, you know, punish you if you don't. And specifically to violence against women and girls, these are guidelines. These are not mandated rules that companies have to follow. Rather, it's kind of a booklet that is given to industry actors, and here specifically online and user-to-user content sites, on what they should do when it comes to violence against women and girls and preventing against it. But again, it's not mandated. And again, some of these things might be a bit high level, but it's better than nothing that we have right now. But it's not a requirement for companies to follow them. Whereas safety by design is like, again, it's not mandated. It's like practices. It's best practices. So it's a very fluffy concept.
You know, I was glad you mentioned the Online Safety Act, because of course that's been the source of a lot of argument over the last few years, and it came into force what, last year, I think, and it covers a lot of online harms, not the ones that I would have liked to have covered, but it always seems to me that this connection between what they call harmful but not illegal content online and harms offline are not necessarily very clear. And it seems to me that the case you've built for the way that technology can be abused in the home and in the real world is much clearer. So, I mean, are there things that you wish were in the act that are not?
Yes, undoubtedly. So I share the concern that the focus is on online, because as our research shows, and also we prefer that the terminology technology facilitated, because again, not every system needs to be, you know, online. It could use different network capabilities, and equally, not everything is user to user content, which is also the focus of the Online Safety Act. And so for us, it would be far more future forward thinking to talk about technology facilitated abuse, and then encompass things like smart devices, such as hidden spy devices, and regulate them as well, because they are actually also an avenue through which harm occurs, but that are not falling under anything that allows manufacturers to be punished, other than product safety issues. But again, like we could have a separate discussion around
we're
that.
We're happy to guarantee that your spy device won't electrocute you.
Yes. Yes.
Yeah.
But So one of my issues is with the focus on online. Another big grievance I have is anything that currently is discussed around online safety is automated and equated with child safety. And I really appreciate the concern around this, but vulnerable groups of people are broader than children. And you know, you don't start to become less vulnerable because you suddenly turn 18. And I think it's important to also shift the emphasis of online safety away from the constant discussions around, like, you know, social media and, you know, children being exposed to suicide information and whatnot. While that is important, it is a far broader category. Just like we need to talk about tech, we need to talk about harms as broader than just the harms that are faced by children. Again, I do absolutely not say that that's not important, but I think it is deflecting from issues such as domestic abuse and intimate partner violence, where children are affected, but also adults. So that's a second point where I have some issues with the act or with the things that have followed consequently. And the third one is that I feel there is little, like there's this guidance, there is this hierarchy between what's mandated and what is optional. I appreciate and understand why it is very hard for Ofcom to mandate this. For example, misogyny is not a hate crime. So it is very hard to, you know, punish anyone for saying things that Andrew Tate is sharing on, for example, YouTube. Whereas it is far easier for someone that shares child sexual abuse material to immediately get them off the internet and off devices. So I appreciate that, but that just showcases some of the gaps that we need to fix to make this enforceable. And I feel like these were three things where I believe it became a bit too short-sighted. On the online, like, illegal, harmful but not illegal aspect, again, misogyny here, but we have seen loads of examples of that, because you said I have more concrete examples, because my immediate thought was, actually, you know, I struggle with that as well. A good example, and one that I give over and over again, is one of the cases we have seen was a victim and survivor that whose partner sadly had killed their cat. Just to make them miserable and harm them, and then used Facebook to kind of and other platforms to kind of post the picture of the cat over and over at specific dates again. Now, you could say various things here. You could block them. Of course you could. But again, I could tell you various reasons why a lot of victims and survivors would choose not to, because they'd rather know what they're doing and planning. And the other thing is, posting a cat picture is not illegal. Now, what should that person do? They can report that cat photograph, right? I also understand from a Facebook or any platform's perspective, that user has not done something wrong by posting that cat picture. It's only if you look at the context around it that you're able to put a measure to the meaning of that picture here.
One of the online sources of abuse lately is the posting of things that don't really exist in reality, but have been created by either artificial intelligence or just, you know, the old school way of using a graphics program to create photographs that don't really exist. How can people fight that sort of thing?
Yeah, I mean, there's loads of discussion around, like, deep fakes and the creation of, for example, non-consensual intimate imagery that is being shared online without the knowledge of the person nor their consent. And that doesn't necessarily have to be real images, but as you say, fake created ones. One debate is about IP rights, so intellectual property rights, and if we could somehow make sure that people have ownership and authority over their face, their voice, and how it is being used, which right now doesn't really apply as such to that, but that is at least one discussion that is happening right now in how to mitigate the misuse of, for example, my picture that's online on the university website in pornographic material or other circumstances that I'm not consenting to it being used.
You know, a lot of what we're talking about here implies a whole load of training issues too. I mean, I can think of like situations where things are happening that are problematic that you couldn't really like design for. Consider, you know, let's say there's a difficult breakup between a man and a woman, and they have children, and their children have phones, and their phones have tracking, and the tracking is turned on for the guy, and the guy is potentially violent. You can't really design for that, but it would be important for the woman in that situation to know that she needs to do something about the location tracking on that phone. So there's all sorts of training issues like that. And I just wonder if anybody is working to kind of address what people need to know to protect themselves.
Yeah, I mean, there's no shortage of guidance out there, but again, like, you know, it's about like when does that reach you? Probably in at a time when you would need to know about it. You're not looking for it or can't look for it, or it comes to you too late. So this information is out there, undoubtedly. Like, there's dozens of websites where there's advice for victims and survivors around like tech safety steps they can take in these circumstances. I actually more profoundly would take a step back and ask the question, why do we even have the functionality to spy on children?
This is one of those things, isn't it? Because when we were kids, I mean, Scoop and John and I, you know, our parents, if we went out, our parents couldn't follow us that closely. And yet we did live to grow up.
Yeah, they had
But
no idea where
parents
we
today,
were.
but parents today are much more frightened, I think.
Yes. And I mean,
Helicopter
inherent.
parents, they call them. You know, they really try hard to keep track of their kids, but I kind of see the point. I mean, I understand wanting to do that, keep track of your children to the extent that, you know, if they're carrying a phone with them, you might want to know where that phone is going.
So my response to that would be, what message are you sending to children about that? And we actually do research on perpetrators as well. We actually do also research on parental control surveillance apps. And an unexpected parallel we have seen is the perpetrators we're interviewing are articulating the same reasons why they're stalking, spying on their partner as the parents are. In both cases, they're saying, I love you and I want you to be safe. I'm thankfully one of those generations that also had no phone in their pocket when I was running around in my village. And I had that pleasure of growing up with that level of uncertainty. And I think I really am worried about the generation growing up that think it is normal that surveillance is a default and also a sign of A, safety, and a B, a sign of love.
I
Because
worry about it
what,
too, because it's in the schools. The
but also
schools
in
track
employment
kids to,
context.
yeah. Sorry, go on.
I just feel like when I talk to parents, like the first response is, well, you know, the functionality is there, so I'm going to use it. So I initially my question is, should we just not allow this functionality to be there? Because parents will use it, but also other people will misuse it. But also the children grow up thinking that that is a sign of love, and there's no difference in your father or your mother telling you, I love you and I need to know where you are, to the first relationship that these kids will have, where a partner says the exact same thing. And why are we making that differentiation that parents are allowed to do that to their 12-year-olds, often without their knowledge? We say it's not okay when they're, you know, older, and it's still an ability, like the inability to consent to that, something like that, because there's so many things entangled with parental relationships with children, just as there is with a personal relationship you have with an intimate partner.
Yeah, I guess part of the question there is whether it's by agreement. I mean, if you're tracking somebody and they don't know about it, I can see calling that surveillance. But if they kind of know that you're tracking them and consent to it, then that's just, I don't know, sharing information.
But under what circumstances was the consent obtained also?
Well, that's a question too. Absolutely.
And also, is a 9-year-old able to fully appreciate and understand the consent they're giving to at that moment of time? And again, it becomes more interesting when we go into like 11 plus, where things become a bit more difficult, where, you know, teenagers might deliberately and rightfully have things that they like to share, not share with their parents, whether this is their sexuality, you know, their crush. And that is being taken away from children by many of these systems that, like, you know, even allow not just from geolocation tracking, but the reading of messages, et cetera.
I was just thinking about, you know, I have two adult grandchildren and they share their location with me, so I can see where they are. But, you know, it's not like I'm tracking them or anything like that. I share my location with them too. It's just, it's handy sometimes, you know, or my wife and I share our locations with each other.
What if the system were designed so that you could always see when somebody had looked to see your location?
That's actually a good point. I think you can turn that on.
That was a design feature very early on when this kind of tracking was first becoming possible. It was the Olivetti Research Lab in the 1990s in the UK did an experiment where everybody had this badge. And you could use the finger, you know, the Unix command finger to look at the badge. But if you did, it was logged and the person could see that you'd looked. And the researchers used it to sort of see if somebody's office was empty, if they were trying to come and talk to somebody, whether they were there and whether they were alone or in a meeting, this kind of thing. And, you know, the press got very exercised about it. But as Andy Hopper, who ran the lab at the time, said, you could simply defeat the badge by putting it in a drawer, and there was no requirement to carry it, you know. But it was an experiment with that kind of, but the important principle that he embraced was reciprocity and transparency.
I think one question is, what power relationship is implied? I mean, is this an act of power, you know, or are the parents imposing too much power over their children by tracking them wherever they go? How much power should a person have over another person?
As I say, like, we really saw the parallel in narratives between the perpetrator study that we're conducting and the justification parents articulate why they are using tracking software on their children. Now, I do not want to simplify and equate that like one-to-one, but I inherently do feel the minute we have that functionality, you will use it. And just as we have discussions right now about should there be a feature such as, you know, when you like the loops that you're seeing with social media, perhaps we have to get rid of that. I'm raising the question, have we gone a bit too far with the functionalities of just because we could track you with your phone, we should do it? And that it's an act of care, an act of safety, because equally I have several questions that follow up from that. Is there any evidence that actually, you know, quantifiably there is more safety as a consequence of us using that device? And does it not cause more harm because A, people are misusing it, and B, I know of so many cases where people become really obsessed to kind of constantly check where are they, and the anxieties that people get when, you know, it's not like you know, when they're not in the location it should be, or anything goes off the rail that's not like normal and expected. And often there are, again, really justifiable reasons why that happens. But I feel like we could nearly do like a weighing of the pros and cons here. And currently, I do not see that the pros are so much bigger than the cons.
Well, one of the problems in the United States with domestic violence, domestic abuse, is there is no national legislation, really. They are only able to do those kind of laws on the state level. So there's, you know, 51 states, you know, and each one is different. And there are 13 states that don't allow the courts to take, to force a domestic abuser to give up their guns. You know, gun violence is epidemic in this country, and they have plenty of lawyers and politicians and groups that want you to have a gun. And that is one of the big problems. And I don't know that, you know, the UK or the European Union has anything, a problem like that. I'm not familiar with the legislation for domestic violence over there.
I mean, in a similar fashion, like Europe or the European Union is not like one state either. And like, you know, if you go to Germany, there's a different legislation than to Austria and Italy. And even in there, there could be several rules. Like, for example, Germany is a very federalized like state. So there's difference here as well. So it's very hard here as well to kind of give a generic answer. Undoubtedly, there is loads of research showcasing that like the risks in the US with regards to access to firearms is far higher and far more prevalent. But I'm not going to disregard the fact that that can happen here as well, because there are definitely cases where, again, police force officers, military personnel have used, you know, their weapons to commit a homicide or a femicide in that case. So you know, it is, I don't even know how to answer this question, because like I feel like there's parallels and differences on both sides here.
I mean, there's such a range of concerns. On the one hand, there's just the fairly minimal concern about privacy. We all want to have a certain amount of privacy. I think to the extent that we socialize and to the extent that we share about ourselves, we give up some of our privacy, but that's completely within our control. And I think kind of in the more extreme situations that you're dealing with, it's not just a question of whether you have privacy, but also whether you can feel safe and you know, whether there's some power relationship that can diminish you in some way, and whether that is facilitated by technology. And I think that's kind of a huge subject. I find myself wondering, you know, what's the impact of AI? I mean, we talked about it a little bit earlier, but it seems that AI has there's some unknowns about how it might be implicated in some of these concerns that we have.
Yeah, I mean, that's a really big topic. Perhaps what I can say on one thing that our research is showcasing is, I think as a society, we need to have a similar conversation we had and still have, unfortunately, around sexual consent. So the parallel we're offering and giving is, you know, just like as a society now, we know, for example, a rape can occur in a marriage, which previously wasn't like legislated and illegal. We also know, for example, if a person is not able to give consent because they're, for example, intoxicated, they're sleeping, or they don't have the mental capacity to say yes or no to something, then it's not okay to have, for example, sex with them, you know, that these discussions around sexual consent are the same one we actually now need to have around technology. Because I see physical devices like smart, and not just physical devices, digital system as an extenuation of my bodily autonomy. And that's, I think, what we need to go with our conversations. Just like nobody of us probably wants to share right now our phones with each other or our browser history or what we have probably asked ChatGPT or Claude, whatever you're using right now. I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't feel comfortable with you sharing my diary or what else. And all, let's be honest, most of us, our diaries are probably not digital anyway. So I'm just trying to give you a conceptual lens to look at digital systems in a way that we have to have had as a society conversation around what is not okay when it comes to sex and the aspect around sexual consent. We need to have a conversation as a society around what is digital consent. And to give you a very concrete example here, because we talked about children, but also the dimension of power, I think, again, and that relates to my worry about what lessons are we teaching right now young kids, young adults, about what is normal. You know, there should be no consequence for me to say no. Just like I can say no, you know, I can bring someone home and, you know, they might think we're going to have sex, but I can still say no. Just because I have given you access once to my Netflix account doesn't mean there should be a consequence when I swap around, and I should have no justification. Because I think another thing we have seen from our perpetrator research is the minute you are saying, for example, I do not want you to read my messages, or I do not want you to share my location with, you need it. You need a justification for that, because otherwise, there's something fishy. There's something wrong. And do you see the parallel here? I don't need a justification why I no longer want to have sex with you. And equally, I should have no justification needed whatsoever why I no longer want to share my password with you, why I no longer want to have access to you. So just like your two grandchildren right now, you shouldn't feel suspicious or have any, you know, power over them for them to turn around and say, you know, I no longer want you to access that. But we are not there as a society. And in fact, I think we are actually rather moving in the direction where we think we endorse this. Like we say, you must buy into the sharing element, or the you know, if all my friends are on Snapchat and I'm the only one that doesn't, does that make me uncool or weird or, you know, the outsider? It should be normal to say no and okay to say no, and parents should endorse that. But I think, again, you cannot have that conversation if you're the one that monitors your children.
Got it. We actually were out of time now, and I'm sitting here thinking of other things I'd like to say. I hope you come back, because I think there's a lot more to talk about.
For sure.
Okay, well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can stay in touch with Plutopia at plutopia.io. On Facebook, look for @Plutopia News. On Twitter, it's @Plutopia. This is the Plutopia News Network, 20 minutes into the future.